Everyone, but most importantly, Debbie. I'd like to call the meeting of the May 27th meeting of the House Education Committee to order. First of all, you'll notice I'm not the chair of the committee. She's testifying before another committee, but I welcome you all, especially our young constituents here. Welcome to the Education Committee. You're what this committee is all about. Great. We are going to open with a public hearing on Senate Bill 637A, and we have Senator Bonamici here, so I will open the public hearing. And you want to just describe the...
SB 637A requires school governing body to adopt an integrated pest management plan, IPM, for use on campuses of the school no later than July 1, 2011.
Okay, Senator Bonamici, welcome.
Thank you, Vice Chair Denbrough and committee members. I'm Sam Bonamici, and I represent Senate District 17, which is in the northeast part of Washington County and northwest Portland, and I'm very pleased to be here today in support of Senate Bill 637A, and thank you so much for hearing this bill today. This is a bill that I started working on through a work group that I was asked to chair by then-Senator Brad Avakian from the Senate Environmental Committee of 2007. And I got a work group together to address the issue of pesticide use in and around schools. And I had a very diverse work group. We at times had sometimes 30, 40 people attend, very diverse, ranging from experts in the field. We had people from the Integrated Plant Protection Center at Oregon State University, and I especially want to acknowledge them for their technical expertise. We had Oregon Environmental Council, Oregon Texas Alliance, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, people from forestry, agriculture, a very wide range of people, and of course all the school communities, from the teachers to the people who work in taking care of school buildings, school boards, school administrators. So we had a very diverse work group. We had several meetings of the full work group. We had some subcommittees. And our goal was to minimize exposure, especially to children, to pesticides. Integrated pest management is not a new concept, but one that's becoming discussed more frequently and becoming more prevalent. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency actually recommends integrated pest management for schools at present, and from there, on the front page of my testimony, you'll see a quote from their website that they do recommend that schools use integrated pest management to reduce pesticide risk and exposure to children. So that's what Senate Bill 637A does. It provides a structure for integrated pest management in Oregon schools. I'll do a brief run through. Section 1 makes the act part of the ORS chapter on pesticide control. Section 2 contains a lot of definitions, including the components of school integrated pest management, what constitutes an emergency, and it clarifies which schools are covered by the bill. Section 3 requires that the governing body of the school adopt an integrated pest management plan. It makes it clear that the plan does not need to address the issue of things like disinfectant, deodorizer, insecticidal soap. Section 4 addresses the role of an integrated pest management coordinator and the training that's needed to take on that role. Some of the experts on the work group emphasize the necessity of training for an effective program, and the Oregon State University and their Extension Service have been working very hard on that. In fact, they actually have a person at the... in their office who is dedicated now a part of his time to specifically integrated pest management in schools. So he's been working regionally and nationally as well as in the state on getting resources ready for this program. Section 5 clarifies that a low-impact pesticide can be used if the integrated pest management is followed and found to be ineffective. It also requires that if there's a pesticide application at a school, it needs to be done by a licensed applicator. Section 6 covers when a pesticide can be applied, and also Section 7 deals with providing notice to parents, students, and staff. Section 8 contains requirements for record keeping. Section 9 makes it clear that the school can adopt any integrated pest management plan that meets the requirements of the statute. And the reason we put that in, Mr. Vice Chair, in committee is because there are several integrated pest management plans already in existence now. And actually, the time frame that your committee administrator mentioned is when there needs to be a model plan adopted. The act itself doesn't take effect until 2012. So there are plans, both the one that is being devised by Oregon State, but also many online in existing districts that already use integrated pest management. Now, I anticipate that you're all thinking unfunded mandate. What about the cost of doing this? Well, I want to tell you that the research that I have conducted shows that integrated pest management can be cost-effective. Some of the districts in the state have already implemented it and can provide guidance, but I want to tell you about just a few that I found. Santa Barbara, California, there's a school that is actually saving money when they reduce costs when they switch to integrated pest management. An integrated pest management program at University of Rochester resulted in a 50% reduction in costs, a substantial reduction. Pennsylvania, 21 school districts that were using integrated pest management, 81% of those were able to control pest problems with little or no change in costs. Montgomery County, Maryland saved $1,800 per school, but they also saved $30,000 at the food service warehouse by addressing problems with pests at their food service warehouse. Santa Monica, California reduced costs of pest control services by 30%. So integrated pest management, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, does have the possibility of actually reducing costs, especially for those districts that are doing something called calendar spraying, where they come in and do preventive spraying on a calendar basis, which is not something that is consistent with the policies of integrated pest management. But as you're considering that issue, I also want to point out that, first of all, we modified the bill considerably. There really isn't any enforcement in the bill, and it's one of those bills, Mr. Vice Chair and committee, that there are certain groups that wish it would have gone farther, and there are certain groups that think it didn't go far enough. And frankly, I would have preferred to have a very strong enforcement and oversight. But in this time where we are right now with budget concerns, I thought it was important to take those components out of the bill, but still get the structure in place so that school districts can begin learning about integrated pest management. Because, in fact, the Environmental Protection Agency is working toward having all schools in the nation using this by 2015. So I submit that it's important for us to be ahead of the curve in protecting the health of our students and staff at Oregon schools. And I also want you to consider the risk management aspects of something like integrated pest management and the long-term health costs that can be avoided by implementation of the provisions in this bill. I hope I attach this page. Maybe it's not in this testimony. I will email it to you. There's a section in the EPA about what organizations are saying about integrated pest management. And I will, I'll make sure I get that to you because it's really a fascinating area that's becoming more and more used throughout our country and there are very positive comments about how it can reduce exposure to pesticides and effective pest control. So there are others here who have much more scientific and technical expertise. I know Renee's here from the Oregon Environmental Council. And as you listen to their testimony, I'd like you to please keep in mind that children may be especially sensitive to risks that may be posed by pesticides because of their behavior. Oftentimes they're out playing on the grass, putting their fingers in their mouths. Plus their internal organs are still developing and maturing. Exposure has the potential to harm a developing child in many ways during critical periods of human development. The use of integrated pest management can help reduce those pesticide exposures and provide additional benefits by reducing pests and their associated allergens with a possible reduction in asthma triggers. And that's something that I thought was very interesting, that the the people we were working with at Oregon State talked about, in they are integrated pest management experts, and they were talking about how where integrated pest management is adopted, they have seen a significant reduction in the allergens that trigger asthma. So that's an additional health benefit. So, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, I do urge you to send Senate Bill 637A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation, and thank you for your attention, and I'll make sure that I get that additional information to you. I try to save paper by only submitting my actual testimony, and this way you'll have the link to the many different websites. I highly recommend that in your spare time that you take a look at some of those websites, because there is quite a lot of information out there from the Integrated Pest Management Institute has a whole section on schools, and a lot more resources are available. So thank you very much, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Okay, thank you, Senator. We're going to take some questions of the Senator and then move on to President Courtney, who is here to testify on a bill. Before we do that, though, let me ask you, if you would, to turn off your cell phones. We're getting some interference through our recording system, and so if you have a BlackBerry, it needs to be turned off or cell phone. Thank you. Okay, questions of the Senator. Yes, Representative Ben Orman.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. Senator, I'm sitting here thinking of the numerous times that I've had to deal with this issue. One of the examples, and without enforcement, I suppose it doesn't really matter, but one of the examples that happened to us is we had this huge outbreak of termites. I mean, huge. The whole classroom was full of termites, flying termites. And so my presumption is that we could do that, but there's protocol for what we do with the children based on this bill.
Sure. Vice Chair Dembrough and Representative Van Ornen, there would be a protocol, yes. First, there would have been prevention measures taken. There's also an emergency clause in here that allows the use of a low-impact pesticide if there is an emergency. And, of course, you wouldn't apply a pesticide with children present.
Follow-up. And then another incident is Head Start centers in the middle of orchards. And the orchardists are still spraying.
And Vice Chair Dembrough and Representative Van Ormen, the reason this work group was called was because there was a hearing on a bill that would have created a buffer zone around schools and routes to schools. And frankly, that is something that may come up in another session. But because it was, let's say, controversial, we wanted to bring an approach that would actually get support in both chambers and take a step forward. There is still an issue of agriculture and forestry spraying around schools, and we did hear about that in our work group, and there are many people who would still like to address that issue. That is a separate issue from the issue that's addressed in this bill. This bill deals with pesticide use in and around a school, on school property, by the school district. So that would be a separate issue if it was an unrelated entity that was doing the pesticide spraying. But I acknowledge that it is something that people are concerned about. There are buffer zones in certain environmentally sensitive areas, and I expect that issue will come up again, but it's not addressed in this bill.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Any other burning questions?
Vice Chair Dembrough, I want to point out that I do support the -7
right.
amendment.
Yes.
We've worked with Oregonians for Food and Shelter all through the work group, and they did hear from someone about the inability to use certain cleaning products, and of course that was not what was intended to preclude that issue. So I do support that amendment to clarify that schools will be able to clean their toilets without having their people licensed pesticide applicators. So I do support that amendment. And thank you again for your attention to this bill.
Thank you for presenting the bill, Senator. We are going to have further testimony on this bill, and we'll have a work session on it, but we'll wait for that. For now, we're going to keep the public session open, the public hearing open, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 444A. And President Courtney, if you would come up and tell us about this bill, that would be great. just before you do, you want to give us a recap of it?
SB 444A prohibits student organization or its members from intentionally hazing potential members.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. President.
Thank you, Vice Chair Dimbrough and members of the House Committee of Education, Representative Ann Orman, Representative Harker, Representative Maurer, Representative Roblin, Representative Springer, Representative Huffman, Representative Thatcher. It's an honor and privilege to be allowed to come here today and to be allowed to testify on this Senate Bill 444. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem, 97303. And I am a state senator, District 11, which includes parts of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. And I'm pleased that you would allow this bill to be publicly heard, a bill that I introduced and we worked in the Senate. I'm joined by my staff here because Ms. Pollack is a policy analyst in my office, and she does all the research on my bills and tells me what to say and explains what I introduced.
Yeah.
Helps me in presentations when I get very difficult questions from my fellow senators, be they senators or state representatives, and I can't answer them. So that is why Sasha is here, to make me look good, because it's very important, as I said yesterday in front of the committee, even if you don't win, you need to show well. So with that in mind, we'll see what I do today in front of this August Committee on Education that the House has put together to hear this. This bill, and I believe I have submitted to each of you official written testimony of my position on the bill, was written when I became aware that the Oregon University system, while it has a plethora of policies on hazing, I discovered that when I looked at the ORS, that the Oregon Revised Statutes, interestingly enough, actually excludes under present law particular activities or other athletic teams that are within a college or university, which means that, and I don't know the history of that, that while Western Oregon University has specific policies prohibiting hazing, we had a hazing incident involving our girls' soccer team out there. And lo and behold, when I looked at all the rules and regs, because I am a lawyer, believe it or not, I discovered that the ORS says, but those rules, laws, they don't apply to athletic teams. And as well as other teams or organizations within the campus. And in the use of K-12 is not even talked about. And I thought that was rather peculiar, because here institutions of higher learning were saying, we do not want our coaches or our teachers or our students or our individuals at our schools hazing other individuals because of the very destructive nature of hazing. And as my testimony points out, that a 1999 study by the NCAA and Alfred University found that approximately 80% of college athletes were exposed to some form of hazing, including drinking contests and other humiliations. As a former coach and a longtime fan from sports teams, I realized the importance of both discipline and team building. Hazing is not appropriate to encourage either. I encourage you to take a close look at this legislation, and if in your wisdom you believe it has merit, to pass it out. And I only say that too because I was, not that you would care, I was hazed as a former athlete. You may believe that I may not care, but you also may not be able to understand that I was even a former athlete, but at one time I was. And back in the hills of West Baghdad, Virginia. And I remember very distinctly things being done in high school, which I really don't want to go into. They're extraordinarily humiliating and even physically demanding. And it was the student athletes on the team, myself, others, decided that when we got big enough and tough enough, we would stop it on our own because it was not stopped by the coaches. And so we became juniors in this particular school. We stopped it. And it was a very brutal thing that we had to do to bring it to stop because the seniors had decided it would go on. But there was enough of us juniors, enough of us big enough and fast enough and tough enough as athletes on that particular football team. West Virginia plays a very brutal game of football that we we would no longer tolerate it. But it was very interesting, and I've always remembered that, what was done to me as a ninth grader and a tenth grader, et cetera. And so we don't need to go into all those details, but that was a long, long, long time ago. But so hazing is something that is real. It has gone on. It still does go on in athletic areas as other areas. And so I felt that we should introduce this bill, if nothing else, to make the law consistent with what I believe is our philosophy as a people in our colleges and universities, and even in the colleges and universities themselves, as well as to add K through 12, which I believe we have added. So that's the bill, just sort of speaking at random here, because I could have read the testimony that I had presented to you, but that's the bill. It's that simple, that straightforward. And so with that, Vice Chair Dembro, I'm going to take your questions, your comments, or your criticisms, as is Sasha Pollack, if you, as again, recognizing that she is the certified smart individual in all matters in my office involving my legislation.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. And I should say on behalf of the chair, I'm about to turn the gavel over to her, but what an honor it is for us to have you here talking about this subject on our very last day of work as a session. We come to you, if not hazed, at least well beaten down as a committee and ready for this bill. Am I speaking for myself?
I don't remember any beatings.
We're taking questions.
We're taking questions. Representative Redwine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Courtney, and I read it over and I think it's okay. You know, the National Honor Societies and these other deals do some induction ceremonies, which include sometimes wearing a banner around that they made National Honor Society and that kind of stuff. As I read it, that probably wouldn't be covered in this bill as a hazing activity, and it would probably be appropriate, would be okay. Do I read that correctly? Because one person even actually asked that of me, whether or not some of those little what they call the initiation process, where they have the night before they do a ceremony to get them into the National Honor Society, and then the next day they wear a deal that indicates they were selected. I'm not sure that I appreciate it, but that's...
Chair Gavin, Representative Robert, I'd like to ask Sasha to comment, and I'm going to comment if she does. That way we're on the same page.
Chair Gelder, Representative Roblin, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. To answer your question, depends on how small the sash is. If it does not place a harmful substance on the individual's body or does not confine them in a small space to subject the individual to an unreasonable risk of harm or adversely affect their physical health, it would not be covered by this bill.
And if I may be allowed to add, if you look at what hazing is, A, B, C, D, and then even goes on, it's a rather comprehensive statement, Chair Galser, Representative Roland, as what hazing is. Again, to say, not to make noise like a lawyer, but every single case is a fact situation, and should it go to court, it would be a question for the jury and or the judge. I think Sasha has answered it very well. It is conceivable with that description, that the event that you're describing could end up being hazing. It may not be. In view of your description, I would say no. But then, depending upon what was done in terms of the piece of clothing, et cetera, or where the person was asked to wear it, it could rise to the level of hazing. I can't answer it any better than that, and I'm not trying to be evasive either, Representative Roblin.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Senator Courtney, my son, you know, participated in a lot of sports, and reports at home were never about how he was treated or how the children were treated by the other kids. It was by how they were treated by the coaches. So one of the questions I have for you is that under Section 1, DB, subsection B, it talks about coaches. So my presumption on that line, on page 2, line 3, is that coaches have to be responsible too.
Chair Gelser, Representative Orman, by all means.
Okay.
This is very much meant for coaches and other individuals that deal with the students, be they volunteers, et cetera, but very specifically, coaches are in here for very obvious reasons. Often it's athletic teams is where we have the greatest instances one of the most horrific examples of hazing, either by fellow student athletes and or a coach who either turns his or her back on it or actually participates in some way. Again, I don't want to go into examples, but I'm very familiar with some of these. So the answer to your question is yes. It's specifically noted in the bill.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I missed it in here, but I was looking for the enforcement mechanism. I realized that it's a Class A, it can be either a Class A violation or a Class B violation, but what agency enforces this?
Well, Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, obviously you see where it's listed as a Class B violation with a fine. And, obviously it takes the law enforcement community in some way or other to enforce this. And often in the area of enforcement is where we don't get the action we want. So I'll just leave it at that. An institution could, though, use it in a way to at least severely discipline a coach, short of being fined, if you understand my point, with this piece just simply studying the statute to allow the individuals to be either terminated or severely disciplined, relying on this piece of legislation, even though they don't necessarily have the authority, if you will, to levy the fine or cite, if you understand that. So that's the best I can do with that. I mean, you have district attorneys, you have law enforcement people, and we are saying if you pass this, this is a official statute of the state of Oregon passed by the Oregon State Legislature and signed by the governor that says what we will accept and will not accept. And we expect the law enforcement community to also enforce this to the extent that their resources will allow them to do so. That's the best I can do.
Follow up? May I follow up? Thank you. And I'm just not sure right now, quite frankly. I spent many years writing these kinds of tickets and arresting people for not violations. And it's been a few years, but I guess one of the concerns I have now that it might behoove us to know for certain is certainly an infraction. An officer cannot cite for an infraction unless it's based on an accident and pulls all the information together. But typically infractions have to be signed by somebody who witnessed it. Now, violations, I'm not sure. I'm thinking it might be the same. A crime, certainly, that doesn't apply. So I'm wondering if we're caught in the middle here where there cannot be, and I'm not even promoting that as being correct. I think it's a question worthy of answering. We may be in an area that you can't just call law enforcement, have them do it. I'm not sure. I'd just like to see it enforced, have a way to do that.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, one of the reasons that this legislation was brought forward was to remove that inconsistency between what was currently OUS policy and ORS, Oregon statute. And so I don't know if there's much of an expectation that this will be a crime that's really focused on by law enforcement, but it at least removes a loophole where if someone was charged by the college that they belonged to with having violated the college's policy, they couldn't point to a statute and say, but it doesn't apply to us. Okay. So I can't answer the enforcement question any better than that. I apologize.
I don't have the answer either.
Chair Gelser, there are at Western Oregon University, I'm just going to take that campus because I think at Oregon State University they may use state troopers. At Western Oregon, there are uniformed individuals. However, they don't watch this statement get me in trouble, but I will just say they're not packing, they're not carrying guns, but they are there, and they drive official cars. They are officially involved in some kind of near law enforcement activities as far as that campus is concerned, and I'm sure that they would implement this to the extent that they could. However, they are not, like I believe the Oregon State University actually is served by state troopers, if I'm not mistaken. I don't want to be certified smart Oregon State and get in trouble with the Corvallis representatives or those down there, but I think I'm right on this one. That's a different group of individuals who truly, they are law enforcement. Now, I can't specifically tell you how, given the types of individuals that are fully uniformed at Western Oregon University, although not having guns on them, so they have that kind of enforcement authority. Not that that's the only way you can enforce the law. as opposed to Oregon State, where they're state troopers. But I do think that those individuals would be much more comfortable with this legislation, because at Western Oregon, it was the individuals who filed the reports, did the investigating, and came in immediately and stopped the activity, because they were called in at the student union to stop the activity that was going on with the girls' soccer team. They were brought in, and they did the investigations. They filed the official reports. So it was serious enough. Little did they realize they actually had no authority under ORS statutes to do what they do. Because let me just tell you this, again, not to make noise like a lawyer. If you adopt an administrative rule or policy, it has to be based on an official statute in law, or it has no substance. It has no substance. It's just like in City Hall. If you adopt an ordinance in a City Hall, it has to be based on a charter. Just like if we adopt statutes as we do, it has to be based on the Oregon Constitution. They cannot be in conflict, which, here we go, we could fit all day in the Supreme Court. So they have policies that exist today in the Oregon University system that are in direct conflict with the state law. If you understand what I'm saying. So if nothing else, we're trying to remove that inconsistency on hazing, and we've tried to also say we think it's serious enough to call it a violation in which you can be fined. That's the best I can do, Representative Springer, to answer your questions.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I'll pass on the question, but I do want to compliment you on putting some pretty clear definitions in there.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have a question about the definitions, too. And it's... You know, when I think of hazing, I think, you know, of course, of physical brutality and putting people in danger, but I also think of humiliation, acts of humiliation. And it seems that the original language had more examples of humiliating sort of situations, where the new language is much more sort of physical in its nature. And I'm just wondering what the process was in changing the old language to the new language. Perhaps that could help. Thank you.
Chair Gelzer, Representative Dimbrough, that was a very interesting process. The old language was the reason for the exemption of the old language was because the original definition of hazing included things like calisthenics and other things that are actively part of curricular or athletic activity, so they could not be banned. Currently, that's not as much what we see in terms of hazing. It's, you know, exposure to the elements or, you know, other things that endanger the well-being of the individual. There are a lot of other things that go on that include humiliation. We looked at the possibility of including those. It's my understanding from what legislative counsel has told me that our freedom of speech clauses in the Constitution prevent us from expanding it to that because you have the freedom to humiliate in some ways, I believe. So there are other ways to get at that, but not through here.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Dimbrough, this is a very disturbing question. I was hoping no one would answer me this question, and you did. We pushed as hard as we could to get to where you want to go, I think. Well, get to where your question wants to go. I don't know where you are, but I don't know you that well. And our legislative council down at the other end of the hall really looked into this. We started on this well before the session began. And this is as far as we can go, we understand, with the definition of hazing. Because some of the things I referred to in my past were humiliation, outright humiliation. When the University of Vermont hockey team a few years ago got into the elephant walk, and it cost him their president, who was the former president of Portland State, the whole incident. Clearly, while it could have been it was physical activity, it was extraordinarily humiliating what was done with those young men on the ice, nude, made to walk an elephant walk. And I'm not going to describe what an elephant walk is. And that was humiliation. And it was extremely humiliating. But there also was physical discomfort, et cetera, et cetera. And you do get into a freedom of speech situation. And so it's my understanding this is as far as we can go to try to deal with hazing without getting into all kinds of constitutional implications. And that is the best, again, I can do, Representative Dimbrough, with your very difficult and very critically important question.
And are there any further questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, actually, kind of, this little exchange kind of brought me up. How does this interact or interface with the anti-bullying legislation? Pass the Senate floor.
We just, Chair Yeltsin, Representative, we just passed that on the Senate floor this morning, and it was, the reaction to that bill was extraordinary. One difference is it's more one-on-one. This is more organization, student organization, athletic teams, if you understand. It speaks much more to that, if you understand what I'm saying. It also speaks to specific people, if you understand, specific, because we think we've identified where this takes place. There is an overlap, but basically bullying is, first of all, I don't want to profile, but one of the things is it's usually associated with much younger individuals. The vast majority of this hazing has taken place within an organizational setting, within organizational units, within that organizational setting. Older individuals versus much younger individuals. The bullying statute, as I understand, is aimed specifically at very young children at a very early age to make a statement that we're not going to tolerate certain individual activity. Now, again, that's a general statement, Representative Thatcher, without actually having the bullying statute, which came out of the House, by the way. It came out of the House. Very well done. Thank you. That is my feeling as to how some of the distinctions. I think there is some overlap, but I think bullying was aimed at a very targeted group at a certain age, et cetera, et cetera. This is aimed at much more, I don't understand that. I don't understand what you wrote there. Again, my staff writes me notes. I don't know what you said. But, so that's the, did you want to comment?
I can.
Well, why don't you try to do it? I bring
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, a lot of the things that you see in this bill are already crimes in their own right. Beating somebody with a chain is not something that is permissible under Oregon statute. Mm-hmm. This hazing bill deals very specifically with organizations and members who are trying to become or who are members of that organization, and as a rite of passage, so to speak, or an induction rite, this is something that is done to them. So this is another layer on top of what in many cases is already a crime.
Well, I guess just follow. I'm looking at the bill. I get cheeks. I got a laptop in front of me. But it says creating, little section says creating a hostile educational environment, including interfering with the psychological well-being of a student. So that might cover the concerns that were brought up by Representative Denbrough. I'm just wondering. That's why I asked the question. I was wondering if one would play off the other and cover some of the gaps that were brought up.
Well, and Representative Thatcher, if I may, I think one of the significant differences is that the bullying bill that we passed applied specifically to K-12 schools. It would not apply to a university or college campus. This would, and I think that's part of what the president was talking about, was that this is identifying those types of organizational activities that are beyond the classroom.
Separate.
Yeah. This is athletics. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming, and I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 444 and open a work session on Senate Bill 444. Representative Denbrough.
Madam Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 444A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Denbrough moves Senate Bill 444A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Roebling?
These are really difficult cultural changes to make in organizations, and therefore I think it's very important to have the structural part of the legislature saying this is a structural change we want the people to make. So I appreciate the fact that it was brought to us, and there gets to be a culture at times, whether it's in an athletic activity or whatever, and that perpetuates itself, and until someone takes an active role in stopping that and changing it to a better, healthier culture, doesn't happen. So even though the enforcement may be a little bit lacking, it certainly gives the principals or the presidents or the boards the opportunity to say this is the new culture we're going to start, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Van Orman.
And I want to be sure I understand. The bill primarily pulls out athletics because athletics has been missing in the current statutes.
I think it's any organization, not athletics. Fraternities, sororities.
Yeah.
Any organization.
Okay. Why did...
It lists student organization means a fraternity,
right,
sorority, athletic team, or other organization that is organized or operating on a college,
right,
university, or elementary or secondary school campus.
Okay. And I got confused because that's how we started out. was the discussion of sports. And in the last paragraph on Senator Courtney's testimony, it was about college athletes. Mm-hmm. So it does athletics as well as correct. These organizations outlined in Section 1. Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Pump?
Excuse.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sprouse?
Aye.
Chair Gelser?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes and heads to the floor. Who would like to carry this one? Let's let Representative Springer, because she'll be able to answer the questions about the
Okay, sounds fine to me. No more questions for me today.
I don't care how it's enforced.
And if it's a bad question, she'll write a ticket.
All right, then. So Representative Springer will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 444. I understand that we are still open in Senate Bill 637.
Correct. People have not testified.
All right. We've got a couple that are short where we have nobody testifying. And I think what I'd like to do is get those out of the way first and come back to where we have testimony. That way we make sure we get everything done, since today is our very last day. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 64A. Senate Bill 64A is a bill we've had a lot of discussion about. The base bill clarified the way that excess dollars were to be used within an educational service district. We were trying to use that vehicle to address two other problems. One was how a school district, who pays for education when a student is privately placed in a long-term care facility, like the Children's Farm Home, and then also where is the resident district of a student when they are attending school in a place that their parents do not live. It was not possible for us to figure that out. It turned out to be more complicated than one might expect. So there are no amendments to the bill, and it is my hope that we can pass to the floor today Senate Bill 64A and not amend it any further. And I would take a motion to that effect.
I'm sorry, so are there amendments?
So, no amendments, just the base bill.
Right. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 64A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
So Representative Dimbrough moves Senate Bill 64 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Do people remember this bill? Do you need a minute to... Are we okay?
Mm-mm. No.
Okay, so seeing no defense testimony.
No, sorry.
Are we okay to call the roll?
Yeah, we're fine. We're fine.
All right, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Pump?
Excused.
Representative Merrill?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbrough?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes. Who would like to carry this one?
Did Representative Van Orman ask a question?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Representative Van Orman will carry this bill.
You're going to help me, right?
Thank you very much, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 64. Okay, everything else we have left requires talking. So let's go back into Senate Bill 637A. So I would invite Renee Heckenmiller and Terry Witt, please. Why don't we wait until after this one? And because we have a number of things that we need to get to, I'm going to ask you to be very brief, if possible. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis. I'm the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council. I will be brief, just to reiterate a couple key points. Senator Bonamici covered very well. Oregon Environmental Council does support SB 637, the -7 amended version, requiring the adoption of integrated pest management. We want to thank Senator Bonamici for her leadership in this issue. And as she pointed out, the version before you is truly reflects the input of a diverse set of stakeholders, and everyone compromised on this bill. And I think the bill we ended up with is something that the majority of us fully support. So it really, really was a compromise on everyone's part to get to this bill. Just want to quickly remind you that it's estimated that over 80% of schools in the U.S. are applying pesticides on a regular basis, whether they need to or not. And not only is this problematic because of the link between pesticides and health problems in children, such as asthma and neurological problems, but also because it's unnecessarily wasteful and not always an effective way to manage pests, not always the most effective way to manage pests within the school environment. The integrated pest management is an approach that uses all the tools in the toolbox. It allows the use of pesticides when sanitation and exclusion haven't worked, but it prioritizes how pests are dealt with within the school environment. 14 states and many school districts, including several in Oregon, have already adopted IPM programs that have proven effective at managing pests, reducing the use of pesticides, and in many cases generating cost savings. And according to the EPA, which encourages schools to adopt IPM practices, practicing IPM can reduce pesticide use in the school by up to 90%. So put simply, school IPM is a well-tested pest management system that can significantly reduce children's exposures to pesticide while effectively and economically managing pests in the school community, and we urge your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gilsud, members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. And like many others, we participated in the work group over the interim and have worked closely with Senator Bonamici amending Senate Bill 637. We support IPM. We have supported IPM for years, including the passage of the state's IPM bill, along with Oregon Environmental Council back in, I think it was like 2000 or 2001. It is a very responsible approach to pest management. And the one key that I think everyone needs to understand is that the pest is the problem. And we do need to have mechanisms available to control the pests. That also is a very key element in providing a safe school environment for our children. The one thing that I would like to enter on the record is that this bill does not really take effect from the standpoint of mandating that schools have an operational IPM program until July 1, 2012. And I think there are some details in the bill that we probably need to flush out a little bit. What typically happens is when you write a bill that is as complex as this one, things start to come out as more and more people look at the bill and find unintended consequences. And I think the A7 amendments are indicative of an unintended consequence. It was never the idea that this bill would require a food handler in the cafeteria to be a pesticide applicator in order to wipe a surface with a disinfectant, or a janitor to clean a urinal to be a pesticide applicator. That was not the intent. The way the bill language evolved, that would have been the consequences had not the A7s been, or if the A7s are not adopted. Furthermore, it would require an emergency to be declared in order for them to even apply, because many of those compounds would not fit the definition of a low-impact pesticide because they carry a warning label, not because the product itself is hazardous once it's used in the environment, but you don't want to get it in your eye. So it has a warning, do not get in your eye, can cause severe burns. And that's true of bath and tub cleaner and those kind of products as well. Lysol, they all carry warning labels saying do not get in the eye because they can cause burns from the standpoint of the concentrated material. So I think we're all going to be looking at the various elements of the bill during the interim. We do support it. We do support the A7 amendment. And I think we'll find some more of those unintended consequences that we will probably have to deal with. Hopefully we can do that in the 2011 session to make sure the bill doesn't place undue burden on the schools. One of the things that could, for example, be extremely cost burdensome to the schools is it requires that every single parent and and or guardian of every student be notified in writing at least 24 hours in advance of a pesticide application. A lot of the IPM programs work on a program where parents or guardians would sign up if they wish to be notified, and that obviously decreases the burden on the school in terms of notification process. So I think there's some tweaks that the statute would allow us to make once we look at the basic details. And I think before closing, I would like to answer Representative Van Orman's question regarding the use of agricultural pesticides and by agriculture and forestry. That was looked at. I think one of the main reasons we did not tackle that at this point in time is that the data really showed that from a school child exposure perspective, the vast majority of situations where exposure did occur, it occurred because the pesticide was actually applied in the school, either by a janitor or in many cases by the teacher. And so that's why we basically concentrated on that particular universe, as it was the universe that had data to show that it was, in fact, a potential problem. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Are there questions for this panel?
I don't know. Are we going to have more testimony, or is this it?
We have two more.
One more panel
with two people on.
Because my question, I don't think that they're prepared to answer it knowing who they represent, but if there's notification sent out and the parents know that, okay, there's going to be some pesticides applied in this particular classroom or particular area, then what? Are the parents then given the option to withhold their child from school for however, whatever length of time? That's what I'm wondering. Like I said, I don't expect you to answer that, unless you want to.
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, that's one of the unintended consequences that I think we need to address is what does happen? Is that a viable reason for not sending a child to school? I don't think we've addressed that yet.
Do we have someone here from the sponsor's office? Would it be helpful to get someone from the sponsor's office here to answer that question?
Or maybe the schools. Maybe they can interpret what they think.
Okay, great. It looks like yes. Yeah. I'm seeing mixed responses from the people that are coming back.
Well,
Representative Van Orman.
Well, I was thinking, you know, knowing some of the struggles that parents have, the option to keep the child home probably isn't an option because they're working and they don't have any resource for the child. So they would send the child to school anyway. So I think it depends on what circumstances for the parent, if there's somebody there who could take care of the child, because so many of our parents work.
Representative Mayor.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm hoping we don't have schools out there that are applying pesticides in violation to the label on the product. And you know what is wrong with asking the OSBA to establish a model policy that says districts, you need to do this, and let's come back in a couple of years and say if you are doing it, then we need to pass a law, because apparently the feds are going to required by 2015. So I guess, is this going to comply with the federal law, or do we not know? Did someone just make that up? Is in fact it law? I don't know.
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer. It actually is a recommendation from the EPA that all schools adopt an integrated pest management policy by 2015. So it won't be, as my understanding is, it won't be required. It's a recommendation. And while schools are supposed to, everyone who uses pesticide is supposed to follow the label, but as we've learned from some incidents that have happened at schools, from a lack of training and understanding of what is okay and not okay, it doesn't always happen. And through putting an integrated pest management policy in place that has designates who is supposed to apply pesticides in what manner, in what situation, and how pests are supposed to be managed, it's hoped that we'll have a uniform standard and we'll have less of the problems, hopefully no problems, but that we won't have some of the incidents we've had in the past. Does that address the question?
It does, Madam Chair, but I'm opposed because it's just one more thing on a school district. They should have a policy anyway, granted, but we don't have to pass a law. I mean, they're not prohibited from establishing a policy today. So, you know, good superintendents, good leaders, good managers ought to do it on their own. You know, maybe it's a little coaxing, but I don't think we need to have a law.
President Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Terry, you went where I want to go with this question. Some of the feedback I got from one of the school districts in my district, the guy that would be in charge of this, he has a new title, I forgot what it is. His only concern was, he said, sounds like a good idea, fine, we do that anyway. However, he said, if any product that has the word warning on it is a big red flag, he says, basically everything, and quite frankly, the toothpaste in my office desk has the word warning on it. I realize, I'm assuming my toothpaste isn't a pesticide, but it has that word on it. So I think we're wading into some of those unintended consequences right there. I'd like to hear some of your thoughts.
Chair, you also Representative Springer. That's correct. And I think in my investigations after the fact, the word warning probably applies or appears on probably about 80% of the over-the-counter pesticides that are out there right now. Mm-hmm. And again, primarily it's not because if it's used properly, it represents a hazard in the environment once it's used. It's typically because the material has some characteristic like keep it out of your eyes or cause burning, cause irritation. That's typically what the warning is for. It's for the applicator, the person using it, rather than the people who may be exposed to it once it's in the environment. So I think that's an area where we probably need to look at, because it really doesn't, those are the kind of products that you and I can go down to Fred Meyer's and buy and use in our home without a license. But we are requiring that the school, if they apply the same material that you and I can apply, Roundup to your driveway, for example, would require a pesticide applicator's license to do that. And I think it also needs to be noted that the people who do this for a living, the professional applicators, they basically apply only when school children are not there. They typically apply in the evenings or on the weekend so that the school will not be immediately occupied after their use. So they follow these precautions. There are, and on some of these products, specific reentry times. In other words, it is against the law to reenter an area that has been treated within a certain amount of time. And so there are laws that do affect this. And unfortunately, in many cases, the school teachers apparently maybe need to take a lesson from what they teach their students, which is read. Read the label and follow the label, because they are typically very clear in terms of how they should be used.
Colleagues, I think we need to move on to so we'll take these next two. We just have another panel and a whole lot more bills that we have to get through today.
Are they proponents?
Are they proponents?
They are.
They are. Okay. So Representative Thatcher first, and then Representative Van Orman.
Well, I guess going back to my previous question, if we're going to, and then building upon what Representative Van Orman was saying, if we're going to have these extensive notification requirements, and then we're also going to assume maybe that parents don't have the resources to take their children out of school or do anything about this, if they're notified, then what is the point? I guess my question is what is the particular aim we're trying to, or problem we're trying to solve through the notification requirements.
Chair Gelder, Representative Thatcher, as a parent, I think that one of the it's knowing. I understand that parents can't always keep their children at home. The hope is that through an integrated pest management policy, the pesticides won't be applied when the kids are at school. And so I know that's not a good answer, but you know, if your kid comes home and has a watery eyes or a reaction to something, then maybe you have an answer as to why. It's not satisfactory.
Okay. Representative Gelser.
Yes.
Chair Gelser and Representative Thatcher. To be very frank with you, that was an area that we thought was a little bit overdone. But from our perspective, the schools didn't seem to have a problem with the notification requirements. And so if the schools didn't, I guess we weren't really the party to object.
Yes.
Representative Van Orman.
Well, one of the advantages of being on the Ag Committee is that I read the some of the reports, and I read the report on pesticide reporting system. And it's quite interesting that the major users of the pesticide products are the individual homeowner. And when they tried to query the individual homeowner, most of the people didn't even know what they were using. So it sort of supports what Representative Maurer says, is that we have a huge problem that a lot of us don't know. Even though the label is there, we somehow still have this perception that it's safe. And I'm one of those people. I cannot walk down an aisle with that stuff on it. So I worry about those people who work with all of this. And I'm very sensitive to those products. So I understand what we're trying to do. I just am, for me, it goes beyond reporting and writing things on paper.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for this panel? All right. Thank you both very much. Rob Wagner and Tricia Smith, please. And Lindsay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I'm here testifying in favor of Senate Bill 637. I served on the work group that created this bill, and I can tell you that it was one of the most diverse, largest, longest work groups I've served on. And I have to, and I testified on the Senate side, that I thought Senator Bonamici did an amazing job of pulling everyone who might possibly have an interest in this issue to the table and hammering out a bill like this one. And she did so, and the bill that you see before you has the support of all of that, as far as I know, of that entire diverse work group, because we addressed every possible issue we could think of during the course of developing this bill. The things that I particularly appreciate about this bill are that, first of all, let me say that we have some school districts in the state who have already adopted this, have been enjoying the benefits of an integrated pest management policy plan and program for some time now. They have seen financial benefits in it. They have seen health benefits of their students and their staff, and they were some of the greatest proponents of the creation of this bill that were on the work group. So the point of the bill is to provide the information and the knowledge to the rest of the school districts that don't have the benefit of a large enough staff to be able to research these things on their own. I'd like to stop and answer the two questions that have been asked so far, and then I'll go on with my testimony. And the first question...
And, Trish, I'm going to have to ask you to be relatively brief,
please. I'd be happy
please.
To do that. The first question from Representative Thatcher was, and then what, once parents are notified? The point of the notification is so that parents who have children who may have severe allergies to some of these chemicals can be forewarned of their application, and then they can make a decision about what to do with their child. That's the point of the notice. School district representatives did not think that this notice requirement was onerous and or unworkable in their districts. The things I like the most about this bill, and some of my members testified on the Senate side to this, is that in some districts, as I said, this exists now. Their applicators, their staff are trained in integrated pest management. They're trained in the application of pesticides. They have licenses, and things work well there. Other districts, our members have no training. They're not licensed, and they don't. And the raid can exist in the classroom. This bill is for those districts. We anticipate that the model policy will be developed by the Oregon School Boards Association. They have indicated they will do that. The Oregon State University staff have the ability to help districts with training and with the development of these policies. So we believe there are a lot of resources in place to put these policies in place in the rest of the district that don't have the resources, and that's the point of the bill and why we support it.
Thank you very much. Rob.
Thank you, Chair Gelster, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. I will keep my testimony very limited because I know you have a very busy agenda. And Debbie, it's not my cell phone, I promise. So, I just want to say we're a proud partner in promoting all sorts of comprehensive efforts to promote environmentally sustainable and green schools, including Senate Bill 637. There was also legislation on the Senate side that was introduced around green cleaning products, as well as legislation in this House that didn't move forward around standards for design, construction, and renovation of school buildings that we hope to be looking at next legislative session as well. I guess my one point here, AFT nationally represents 1.4 million members, and we've launched a campaign called Building Minds, Minding Buildings, and it's our union's roadmap to green and sustainable schools. You can find the document. I'm not going to photocopy the 30 pages and distribute because that would not be very environmentally sustainable. So we want to respect that. But the key point here is that there's a direct correlation between student learning, productivity, and educational attainment with healthy and sound learning environments. This is a good bill. It's a step in the right direction, and we are proud to be a partner in support of this passage. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Lindsay Capps, Oregon Education Association. We strongly support this legislation. I won't go into further reasons other than what my colleagues here have said and previous folks who have testified have said, but obviously this is a fairly common sense step we think that can help improve the health of the school environment. Oregon has one of the highest child asthma rates in the country. This is a bill that can help address that, especially in school districts where too often we have dilapidated facilities. This is a step we can take to help improve the health of those facilities for the over 500,000 kids in this state. So with that, I'll say this is a good bill, should pass, and thank the committee for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Why does it have to be in statute? OSBA is going to create model policy, which is how school boards, that's good for school districts that can't write their own. Every district is going to be the same. What about the school district with two and three kids in it? I don't see the need for the legislation now because it's going to be a ramp-up period anyway. It's encouraged. Let's put policies in place, wait a couple of years and come back. We do it all the time here. We encourage people to do the right thing. If they're doing the right thing, then we come back and say you're not doing the right thing, let's fix it. This, why do we need it now?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, we certainly could do that. The thing we would lose, I would think, would be 2 years in the life of a school child that may need us to act now. We have 197 districts. There is no requirement that they ever read the OSBA website or adopt a policy by OSBA. And this is about the health of children and staff members. And whether they are in a large district or a small district, the small districts are the ones that need the help. And this bill will enable them to receive that help in a, we think, a better, more organized fashion than they could find it on their own.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. There's no emergency clause, and it doesn't become operative until July 1st of 2012. So.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman, did you have a question?
No, I did not.
Okay,
thank you.
I had a request card up here. OSBA, it's your lucky day. A member has a question for you. Is there anyone here from OSBA?
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you all very much. You won.
I could play the lottery tonight, apparently.
You never get more lucky than in the education
Powerball's
committee.
$222 million. Help the tax base for the state. For the record, David Williams, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Just very briefly, and then happy to take a question. The Oregon School Board Association did participate in the work group crafting Senate Bill 637, and we want to applaud the efforts of Senator Avakian and Representative Bonamici, and then Senator Bonamici in really pulling all parties to the table and crafting this, what we think was a pretty solid piece of compromise legislation to the point where we support its passage.
Thank you, Representative Springer.
Oh, what a coincidence, and he's here.
In the Education Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, David. I know my school district participated in the boilerplate policies from OSBA. Is there anything about pest management now that OSBA produces?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, and I apologize, I didn't come prepared. We do have a model integrated pest management policy. I don't believe that it exactly complies with the statute as drafted. I'm sure there are several smaller differences. And then, as you know, it is, of course, no district is compelled to adopt an OSBA policy. Right. We do have policies that we call highly recommended policies, and then, of course, policies that comply with statute. It is likely, should Senate Bill 637 pass the legislature and be signed into law, we would work with Oregon State in developing a model policy that would comply with Senate Bill 637 and would be working with districts through an adoption process to adopt that policy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Representative Thatcher?
Looking back... These posting requirements are just, you know, I have to tell you, I was on board totally with this bill. Now looking at the details, I'm kind of questioning that support. But I'm looking at Section 4, page 3, down at the bottom. You're supposed to give notice and post warnings. Okay, so I'm not seeing for how long or when the timing of these particular notices. So what I'm envisioning happening is that they're just going to post a blanket, yeah, we use pesticides sometimes, all the time, which really isn't going to give anybody any information as to when that's happening. So I'm wondering how you would interpret it.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I apologize. I'm at a slight disadvantage. I do not have a copy of the bill. My understanding is that there were certain timelines built into the bill, certain hour notices prior to any application. I knew somebody in the audience would have a copy of the bill. Remind me what page and line.
Well, the notice section is in Section 4, page 3, bottom. I'm looking for time parameters, but maybe it's in a different section.
I think it's in Section 7.
Section 7, okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right. It talks about having a 24-hour notice prior to application, as well as certain length of notice posting post-application as well. And then there are notice requirements. Should emergency application be necessary, you would post immediately. I do not envision, knowing a number of districts who have implemented policies that are more stringent than the one before you today, the notification is not simply a blanket notification on the door of school saying we're going to apply whenever we want to and just be forewarned. Generally, the posting is some sort of a signage at the point of application on the school door, so parents are aware, or students in higher grade levels are aware of that application, and then generally some sort of email or flyer sent out to school districts. I believe the legislation was written such that districts who are more adept at using electronic communication may do that, whereas others, I know, for instance, we get a weekly newsletter printed from my school for my daughter, and a lot of notices in there for parents about things that are going on at the school, and imagine a lot of this would fit in those sort of regular notifications to parents and students.
Okay, follow-up to that question, sorry. Thank you for clarifying that. It was in a different section. It seems like they ought to be together. But anyhow, I'm wondering, we were talking earlier about students and parents making the decision for their students to either, it would explain their runny eyes or whatever physical symptoms they might show. But also employees, do you foresee this? And I intended to ask that while the panel was up here, the employee representative panel was up here, but would you envision this being a part of potentially excused absences. I don't know what you call it when an employee is not able to show up if they have allergies or particular problems with particular chemicals.
Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher, I think that a lot of the notices and the warnings, I think, certainly, while protecting the interests of our children in our schools, I think equally applies to our employees as well. We are very sensitive to the fact that we may have many employees who are chemically sensitive in our schools. And I think on the local level in the school setting, the management and employee in that setting would work through the best possible work plan to handle a chemically sensitive issue in that employment setting. Probably the likely outcome is that those applications will take place outside of the scope of the building being used by employees and students. However, it may also include other accommodations, either accommodations for the employee or the employee choosing voluntarily to take other leave available to them. But I think a lot of that is incumbent on not only labor agreements on the local level, but also the personalities of the management employee involved on the local level.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. In response to what Representative Thatcher said about notification and identification, years ago I got instructions from the state of Washington how we were supposed to post if we should use any particular herbicide, pesticide on the ground, and what size they were going to be, what color they were going to be, and how far apart they were going to be. And I responded appropriately. I never used anything. So I didn't have to worry about signage or posting. And quite frankly, I think there are a lot of school districts, and even if I could, I probably didn't have the money to pay for those chemicals to use. So sometimes the dollar figure always comes into play on these things.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being willing to come up. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 637 and open a work session on Senate Bill 637. Representative
Dimbro. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 637 dated May 26, 2009.
Representative Dimbro moves the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 637. Is there any discussion? Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, quickly, I will be a no. I mean, clearly, it's better when you plan. But I think that the implementation time frame is, quite frankly, not soon enough to meet the needs. And we can, if we're going to take the long-term view, then we need to allow districts to implement it, and then when they don't, and say, you need to do it now.
Thank you. Do you have an objection to adopting the amendment into the bill? The motion was on the amendment. So no on the amendment.
No, I'm fine with the amendment.
You're fine with the amendment. So is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted, and your objection is noted. Is there further discussion?
On
the bill.
I move Senate Bill 637 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbro moves 637A to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Now is there any further discussion? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I grew up on the East Coast. I had the planes flying over spraying for mosquitoes in the summers. While some people would argue, I think I've turned out okay. So I don't have tremendous fear, sensitivity, etc. around this issue. I also have friends who are professional entomologists and have watched the field of integrated pest management evolve over time in this country, other parts of this country, and abroad. And I think it is well established that we can make good progress with this. I think the bill reflects the result of lots of input from people of all persuasions and comes to us with a consensus on behalf of the people who have played a part in that process. And so while it ain't perfect, I think it's pretty darn good, and I will be voting in support of it.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, I have some questions, and though I support the underlying goals, certainly, but I'm going to be a no for now, at least, and until I get those addressed. So.
Thank you very much. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I highly support this bill. I was able to attend a couple of the meetings on that. I had the distinct opportunity that Representative Harker talked about, and having overhead flies, pet mosquito pest control when I was pregnant with one of my children. I thought, I can't seal up my house enough to not have that stuff impact me and my possible baby. And yet then another time in my life, I was working to pay for my college education out in a strawberry field, and they were spraying heavy-duty pesticide, and the mist, again, crossed over the strawberry field from the hop field. And I thought, oh, goodness, what about our health and our workers' health and everybody? And this is just a beginning. It is a precaution. We need to take care of our children.
Thank you very much. Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Van Orden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gembrough?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required votes, the bill passes and heads to the floor. Representative Parker, would you please carry this bill?
Be happy.
Thank you very much. And I wasn't here at the opening of the hearing, but wanted you to be aware that we did have a visitor on Friday when we carried this over. What's Alexandria's last name, Representative Parker? Alexandria is a very well-spoken...
Goddard Comp.
Fourth grader, and she came to talk to us about her support of this bill as well, and I believe that information was sent to you by Kevin at the end of the week, her comments. Since she was not able to share that in the committee, we went to the House floor, and she shared those comments from standing behind the Speaker's dais. So we'll let her know that she helped with this. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 637 and open a work session on Senate Bill 119. Colleagues, Senate Bill 119, if you'll remember, last week on Friday, the underlying bill had to do with a person resigning from public school without providing appropriate notice. The amendment comes from Senator Walker and is supported by the stakeholders, including the Oregon Education Association, that would allow teachers to have the ability to regain licensure after an error. Do people remember this bill from the other day? Representative Zimbro, I take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 119, dated May 6, 2009.
Representative Zimbro moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 119. Is there any discussion?
Representative
Maurer.
Madam Chair, I support the underlying bill. I do not support the amendments. I think there are a lot of issues, and I don't fully understand the implications of this, of the amendment, and will therefore not be supportive, but would like to continue the conversation about what PSBC does with diversion during the interim.
Thank you very much. Is there further discussion on the -1 amendment? Seeing none, Debbie, would you please call the roll on the amendments?
Representative Parker?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
No.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Van Orden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
No.
Vice Chair Gembrough?
Aye.
Chair Gilson.
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion is adopted. And I'm going...
Sure.
No? No, it didn't?
You have to have a majority, right?
Oh, I thought I did.
You did.
It was 5-5 yeah. Five, split.
Three. No.
Four, five.
Five, five.
It was 5-5.
Was it?
I lost
count. No, I have Representative Parker, Huffman, Maurer, Thatcher, and Springer.
All right. Then the motion fails. Representative Dimbro, I would accept a motion to move this bill to rules.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 537.
No, we're on 119.
No, 119, right, sorry. we'll get to that soon. I move Senate Bill 119 to rules without recommendation.
Representative Dimbro moves Senate Bill 119 to rules without recommendation. Is there any discussion?
is there any objection? Seeing none, the bill is headed to Jules. Congratulations, Representative Roland.
Yes, thank you.
Full employment.
At least he knows it.
Yeah, that's true. I could have been in a different committee right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 119.
Madam Chair, could I make a motion?
Would you please make a motion?
I would like to do that.
That would be great.
I make a motion that the rules be suspended so Representative Comp can vote on a couple of bills. Senate Bill 444, I think.
And 64.
And Senate Bill 64A.
Representative Springer moves that the rules be suspended and Representative Comp be allowed to vote on Senate Bill 64A and Senate Bill 444A. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Comp, how would you like to vote on these bills? Senate Bill 64A.
Aye.
And Senate Bill 444A.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Representative Springer.
All right. I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 48A. Senate Bill 48A is the bill that we heard from Senator Przanski about. I've talked with a number of you since that time, and it seems that there were still a number of questions. And so I would ask what your pleasure is about adopting the amendment and moving it to rules.
118. You're talking about Amendment A7?
Yes.
Yes.
Can we move the amendment?
Committee, what is your pleasure on this bill today?
Yes,
Representative.
I don't think we can.
Oh, go ahead, Representative Van Orman.
Well, I was going to say, without the amendment, I think we have a bigger problem.
Yeah.
I agree. I think we need to have the amendment.
The A7.
Yeah, because without the amendment, we've got a problem with somebody who's over 18. And that's not what the bill originally was.
Representative Van Orman, would you like to move the amendment?
Certainly, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt the amendment A7 for Senate Bill 48.
So Representative Van Orman moves that we adopt the A7 amendment to Senate Bill 48. Is there any discussion about the amendment?
I was going to say, Representative Thatcher's just viewing it.
I, for some reason, did not get that. So I would just like...
Sure.
A recap, a small one, if possible.
Oh, the
thrust.
So we're on 48.
Yeah. I can read this, but it really as much as I know.
We're on 48.
We're on 48.
Okay.
I can see it.
Yeah, correct. So I can give Kevin's gone, but
I've done this.
Okay, great.
The -7 amendment on SB 48A. The -7 amendment replaces the entire bill, provides that disciplinary records of school employees or former school employees are not exempt from disclosure if the employee or former employee, 1, was convicted of a crime, 2, was found by TSPC to have engaged in conduct with a student grade 12 or below that would constitute a specified crime, regardless of any age requirement found in the specified crime, provides circumstances under which disciplinary records may be disclosed, establishes procedures for reporting and investigating employees suspected of child abuse or sexual conduct, provides disciplinary procedures to employees in which a claim for child abuse or prohibited sexual conduct is substantiated, provides that TSPC shall revoke any license or revoke any applicant's right to apply for a license if the applicant is found to have engaged in conduct with a student grade 12 or below that would constitute a specified crime, regardless of any age requirement found in the specified crime. Provides
those found by TSPC to have engaged in prohibited conduct from applying for reinstatement of a license or registration permits TSPC to issue a public reprimand or suspend or revoke the right to apply for a license under the specified specific circumstances, declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher?
Well, in light of the fact that this replaces the entire bill, and I don't recall, can we possibly hear if the people, you know, the representatives of the potentially affected people support this or what their views on this are?
Of course. That would be, we can hear that briefly. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a rhetorical question. I sincerely don't know the answer. But there's some blanks on this amendment, like Section 4, Chapter blank.
That's okay. This bill includes the conflict amendments with the other bills that we've passed that have affected this area of the statute, 2062. Okay. So it incorporates both the amendments that Senator Przanski was proposing and what would need to happen to reconcile it with other changes.
Okay.
In the law.
Well, that's just concerning me.
For very good reason.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Denver.
You know, I'm wondering if it might not be best to send this to rules. At this point,
I got lots of week left.
I think that was the intention was to adopt the amendment and send it to rules.
So I would suggest that we adopt the amendment and then follow it with a motion to send it to rules. Is that what you're thinking?
That was what I was thinking. There was a problem in the underlying bill in regards to the age of the student, the way that was addressed. So in order to save a step in the discussion for Representative Roblin's committee, it seemed like adopting the amendment to correct the prior error.
Thank you. Now that I know the next step that you're intending, I'm fine.
Representative, I'll have a comment after the motion's made. We're actually in a motion right now.
I made the motion.
We're in motion. That's great. Well,
we are motioning barreling towards an amendment.
Since the chair of the Rules Committee is sitting amongst us, I would respectfully request that you make sure you understand what grade 12 means, because there's lots of people in grade 12 that are maybe 15. There's possibly people in grade 12 that are 21.
I had one that was 34.
Well, you don't care.
In our school. He came back to school.
That's
he came back to school
for his 12th grade.
He was 34.
I wanted to make sure you have clarity around
that. What do you mean
he
doesn't count?
That's what she said. Representative
Springer. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, that addressed a concern that I had last week that I was wrestling with on a serious note is certainly thinking of my friend whose son has Downs and went to school until 21, he aged out. Was he a 12th grader? You know, I never asked her that question. I want to make sure that we're not losing a group of kids there, that this is really pivotal in addressing the needs of.
And I think Senator Przanski indicated when he was here before that he was very welcoming of such an amendment that would clarify that we weren't losing particularly that segment of students. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Debbie.
No.
Representative Heffman?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
No.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Denver?
Aye.
Chair Gilzer.
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Representative Dembro.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 48A as amended to rules without recommendation.
So recommendation, Representative Dembro moves Senate Bill 48A as amended to rules without recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, I think I have to admit that I was confused about the amendment. So now that that's on the record, I am now straight.
I will.
Is there any further discussion? Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Heffman? Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Hoagland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orden?
I happily move it to rules. Aye.
Aye. Vice Chair Gimbler?
Aye.
Chair Gilbert?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes and goes to rules. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 48 and open a work session on Senate Bill 118A. Representative Parker, would you give us an update on Senate Bill 118? Representative Parker and Representative Dembro have been working with the stakeholders over the course of the past week on this bill that had to do with delegation of authority within the Oregon University system.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, we did indeed have those conversations, particularly one lengthy conference call last week. It seemed to Representative Dembro and myself that this was a bill that would bring about efficiency for the board, maximize efficiency, or at least improve efficiency of behavior of the board, and that to try to get it through would help things move along. And we have the bill was put together at a time before the budget cuts that we're looking at right now, so I figured that anything they needed to improve their efficiency back then, they needed at least two or three times as badly now. We had a conference call, and all of the parties involved had very good, very productive discussion and came to terms where I believe, while I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, and they can certainly clarify while they're here, if need be, everyone came out in support of the amendments that we have before us today. I believe we have two amendments, and the most recent one is the final position that we came out with. I believe it's A7, yes. I didn't say it because there have been so many A7s today. I thought it might be Mr. But it's the A7, and I believe that...
And can you briefly describe what the A7 does?
The A7, thank you, the A7 restricts the breadth of the bill tremendously down to the point where we are delegating, we are giving the board the power to delegate to subcommittees of the board.
And
it also said it doesn't let some things.
True, it doesn't let everything happen. I believe that was in the previous version. But okay. Except for the power to prescribe enrollment fees and the power to adopt rules, the State Board of Higher Education may delegate any of the powers, duties, or functions of the board to a committee of the board.
And could
they not be delegated elsewhere, on down the line, the chain of command, etc.
We have Ms. Pinero and Ms. Unger, please.
Madam Chair, yes, and if I could say that for Representative Parker, this meeting was a conference call, but for some of us, we actually had the pleasure of having presence in the flesh, and these two representatives were two of them, including the Chancellor was there.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Pinero with the Oregon University System, and Representative Parker does reflect our opinion of the Dash 7 amendments. We do support them. They will provide the necessary authority for the board to better utilize their time of the 12 voluntary members that we have that serve on the board to address the complex issues of the Oregon University System. They can delegate then to committees of the board, and then the board, those committees can come back and make their recommendation to the full board. This will be a very, very useful tool for us, and we appreciate the work of Representative Dembro and Representative Harker and others. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Melissa Unger with SEIU Local 503, and I also want to, we do also support the Dash 7 amendments. I felt like the work group was actually very productive in terms of making sure that we all had an understanding of what the different impacts of the bill were, and I think we all came to an agreement pretty quickly, actually, and I appreciate Representative Dembro and Representative Parker for bringing us together, and also the university system, and Paul Kelly, the chair of the board, who actually was on the phone and was able to talk with us about the bill, and I think that it is good that we were all able to come to agreement.
Thank you very much. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can somebody kind of give me examples or describe where the sideboards are? Because I'm reading A7, and honestly, it doesn't tell me a whole lot. And for me to buy into this, I was needing some fences put up. and I'm struggling to see the fences because it sounds like instead of just giving carte blanche authority to the chancellor, the board just gives the authority to subcommittees.
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, I did want to say one thing that made us actually pretty comfortable with this is that those meetings continue to be public meetings, and they continue to have people involved in those meetings. And so so they'll get posted, the agendas will be known, people who want to be engaged in those conversations can be engaged in those conversations, and that there's still board members who are making those decisions. So those were really the reasons that I think we were able to be very comfortable with this amendment moving forward.
Representative Thatcher.
Just to make it perfectly clear, you just said board members would be making the decisions. The subcommittees would only be comprised of board members, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, that is my understanding, is that at least on these committees that that the State Board is forming and has formed, for example, the Governance and Policy Committee, it will have at least 3 members and probably more, like at least 5. There may be advisory members of this committee, of the board, that are not members of the board, but they are from the institution. And as Melissa indicated, these are public meetings. They are posted, notified to the public. Minutes are taken. I mean, this is a board committee of the board. It will be a very public process.
And follow-up, Mr. Manager. And so I'm taking from what you're saying, see if I'm interpreting this correctly, a majority of the members of the subcommittee would be actual board members, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just for some more background, I believe that in these subcommittees, the regular board members are the voting members of the subcommittee, and so they would be the only ones casting votes and making decisions. You know, they may be hearing reports and getting input from other advisory people. You know, this bill had 2 parts, essentially. One that the board was seeking was authority to do more work through its subcommittees. Another was to delegate work to the chancellor and to the presidents of the colleges. And it became clear to us pretty quickly in the meeting that the real concern that stakeholders had was with the latter, that there was consensus that that the former was something that we could move forward immediately with. The board was very interested in doing. It feels hampered in its current constraint, by its current constraints. It would like to have the authority to do that as soon as the bill becomes effective, and then in the interim have some ongoing conversations about the other piece, which would perhaps delegate some authority in a more closely defined manner to the chancellor and to the college presidents. So it became clear that we could split it up that way and reach consensus, and that's what comes before you is the dash 7.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Is there anybody else that needs to be heard on this bill before we close the public hearing? Seeing no further testimony, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118A and open a work session on Senate Bill 118.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 118A, dated 5-2609.
Representative Dimbro moves the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 118A. Is there any discussion? I would just really like to thank Representative Harker and Representative Dimbro for making this happen. I think when we had this public hearing a couple of weeks ago, I left with the thought that consensus probably was not possible to achieve, and I'm glad that it was. So thank you to all of you that have worked to make that happen.
Everyone at the table had great comments, great discussion, and it did, as someone just mentioned, it did happen very quickly once we got people together and talking.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
I echo that and thank everybody that worked on the committee. I did have faith that they could come back with sideboards I could live with. You know, it's just the fiduciary responsibility of the board members that I was not comfortable in allowing them to release too much of that power and authority, because they're the ones ultimately that have to answer to Oregonians. So
Not that I don't trust the chancellor, but maybe the next chancellor I wouldn't trust as much. So, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there? So we've adopted the amendment.
I'm not sure.
You've made them. Oh, we have not adopted the amendment.
No.
Oh, is there any objection to the amendment?
We made the amendment.
Yes, we've had the motion.
Okay.
We made the motion. So, any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the motion is that the amendment is adopted. Representative Dimbrough.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 118A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We can't do that. We don't have the revenue statement.
Representative Dimbrough, would you like to make a motion to suspend the
Madam
rules?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that we suspend the rules in order to move Senate Bill 118A to the floor without a fiscal or revenue statement.
Revenue.
Without a revenue statement.
So Representative Dimbrough moves that the rules be suspended and that Senate Bill 118A as amended be moved to the floor without a revenue statement available yet. Is there any objection to that motion to suspend the rules? So the rules are suspended. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 118A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbrough moves Senate Bill 118A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Huffman. Aye. Representative Cobb. Aye. Representative Mauer. Aye. Representative Brooklyn. Aye. Representative Thatcher. Aye. Representative Van Orman. Aye. Vice Chair Springer. Aye. Vice Chair Dimbrough. Aye. Chair Gilson. Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes to the floor. Representative Parker, would you carry this one, please?
I would love to, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 118. I've misplaced my agenda in the pile.
Senate Bill 537.
Senate Bill 537. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 537. We have people signed up both in support and in opposition to this bill, so I'm going to ask both sides to be fairly brief. As they're coming
really
up,
brief.
Could you give a brief overview? And while she's giving the overview, Cindy Robert and then Lori Wimmer and Tricia Smith, please.
SB 537A permits Department of Education to enter into contracts to audit and evaluate business practices of districts, allows Department to contract the Secretary of State to conduct audits and private entities for evaluations, requires that contracts entered into comply with competitive bidding requirements.
Great. Thank you. Cindy? No, it's not for me.
Madam Chair, as we're coming up on the fiscal, engrossed. I just want to make clear that the fiscal on this is anticipated to be between $700 and $1,000. Is that an accurate statement?
I'm just
not 7 cents.
Yeah. $700 to $1,000. Okay. Thank you.
Is that accurate?
If that's what it I would not take it upon myself to question the wisdom of legislative fiscal.
Okay. Okay, so we'll make sure that so minimal really means minimal.
Correct. So let's move on so that we can hear both of our witnesses since we have to decide what to do on this bill in the next 7 minutes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert and I represent Chalkboard Project, and I will talk very fast, but first of all, thank you very much for giving us a few moments to hear this bill. Simple bill, a national effort to take practices in the business offices, school, making sure they're as efficient as possible so they can send the extra money to the classroom. That's the goal of this bill. In 2007, this body passed a bill that 3141 that allowed the Department of Education to do school business practice audits and to use a best business practices advisory committee and the Secretary of State to do those. That you also continuously appropriated $800,000 for that process.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, just quickly, is this a continuation of pilot projects that Chalkboard did in the last 18
no.
months? Or this is totally different?
Well, no, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, it's not necessarily different. You had already okayed a process where the Secretary of State did these audits through the Department of Education. That cost a lot of money. They did one, it cost over $250,000. We did five with a grant that Chalkboard gave to the Organization of School Business Officials, which was then then housed within OSBA, is now housed within COSA. We granted them $85,000. They didn't spend all of it, but they did five. In this difficult economic time, we're simply asking that the language of the law that you passed in 2007 be changed so that the Secretary of State still does audits, but other groups can do what we're calling evaluations. Same aspects of the business practices, probably not as in-depth, not going to cost as much money. It allows the process to continue. It allows the Best Business Practices Advisory Committee, which includes all the stakeholders, to still have oversight over evaluations, but also allows someone like Chalkboard to help fund those evaluations. So what we're doing with this bill is allowing the process to continue. Doesn't always. There was a study by Echo Northwest of the two processes that says it doesn't always have to be as in-depth. Some schools don't need that, and it doesn't always have to be that expensive. Some schools don't need that. It allows the processes to combine. It allows the Best Business Practice Advisory Committee, which I think is run by Lori Wimmer and Senator Walker, it allows them to make decisions as to which school districts do this. It just says you don't have to use the Secretary of State. It's an expensive endeavor when we do it that way. We don't need to. Representative Maurer, you asked about the fiscal. There was a mistake of it. Initially was put $7,000 to $10,000. That being said, there was no Ways and Means Reform on the Senate side. There is one on the House side, and I believe part of that is because this body continuously appropriated $800,000 for these audits to take place. I think that's something that Ways and Means wants to look at as possibly not something that should be going on.
Right. Thank you. And just so we can get everybody in, Lori and Tricia also, and then we'll call everybody back up for questions if people have questions.
So, Madam Chair, the motion will be to go to Ways and Means.
The bill does have a subsequent referral on it.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing OEA and its 48,000 members. I was the head of a work group appointed in the last session to help create the bill that just passed 2 years ago to create the best practices performance audit, voluntary audit process. And that was to harmonize various different bills and all the stakeholder interests, and we were very happy to work with the Secretary of State, the Department of Ed, and all the stakeholders to create that law. There was an appropriation for 2 years, and we know that because of the fiscal issues that probably is going to be in hiatus status for the next two, but we are very comfortable with the process that we have that is a formal audit process complete with subpoena power and so on, so that the audits are scrupulous and according to general accounting standards. I am, as Ms. Roberts said, vice chair of the Business Best Practices Advisory Committee that created the criteria for the business practice audits to recommend to the Department of Ed, which works with the Secretary of State to perform these. And in there, in contract, includes service, transportation, a variety of business functions. We do believe that there is a place for a less formal, less exhaustive review of financial practices. The pilot was an interesting experiment.
And Laura, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, you have my written testimony. My main point is this. The word evaluation is listed 14 times and is never defined. Any other entities that you can open the school books to are not defined, nor are they required to be qualified in any fashion. We think that the bill is not ready for passage, and we would hope that you would not send it on to Ways and Means or anywhere else unless these can be fixed. We asked for that on the Senate side. We were ignored, and so we were asking that we not tamper with this two-year-old law at this time. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Smith, representing Oregon School Employees Association. I share, OSEA shares OEA's concerns with Senate Bill 537 as it is written. We believe we have a process in place already that is a good process, and we would not like to see it altered as a result of a temporary financial problem. We hope that you will not move this bill forward.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, this bill was referred to us in the middle of last week, which is why we have it so late. I'm uncomfortable moving it with recommendation. I'm uncomfortable killing it in both ways because we haven't had the time to hear it. We do have the chair of the Ways and Means Sub, and I'm thinking we could move it there without any recommendation attached.
Yes.
To
but
it. Would that be a comfortable outcome to the committee, Representative Van Orman?
Well, I'd like to ask a clarifying question,
yes.
If I may.
In reviewing what's being said, we have audits that each school district does, and they have a fiscal audit. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, yes, there are fiscal audits. Those are separate from these.
Okay. So what we're talking about today is to look at best practices to see to help school districts to more effectively manage their money and manage how they spend. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, that is true. It's voluntary. They don't have to do it. It's something that some schools have chosen to do, and I could give you some details on why, but, of course, you don't have time.
Okay. And follow-up. My next question is, are there performance standards for schools so that they know what the goalposts are so that when we're talking about best practices that somehow we have performance standards out there that says that you should be doing such and such and then evaluating them against those performance standards?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, the end result of both the Secretary of State, BPEAC group, and our pilots was to put together templates of best practices, and Chalkboard posted them on websites so other districts of similar size, similar financial status could copy them, even though they haven't gone through them, didn't have the money to go through them, wouldn't in the future. They could use some of those ideas. It is to develop best business practices and share them with everyone. And I believe that the process Ms. Wimmer shared is the same goal.
So so you would be looking at those as performance standards?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parker.
Madam Chair, very similar to what you said, I'd have a hard time voting to move this to the floor, just based on conflicts I'm seeing here between organizations I would like to have in agreement and my uncertainties about it given the amount of time we've had, the very short amount of time we've had. Rules, I could be okay with.
Ways and means.
Yeah, I guess it does end. Just go ahead.
Is there further discussion, Representative Thatcher?
Yeah, this went through public hearing on the Senate side, work session, passed the Senate floor, everybody voting for it except for the ones that were excused. I agree that it's probably not something that it would be appropriate for us to vote and send to the floor right now, but I would definitely support sending it to rules, at least. I don't know why, sending it to Ways and Means feels like a death nail. I would hate to see that happen.
We don't have a choice. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means already on it. If we sent it to rules first, that would kill it, because then it would have to go there and escape. And
okay, thank you for the clarification.
thank you, Madam Chair. I support the options of this bill. I like the fact that it does open it up and give variety, and I would just like to make sure that the chair of the Ways and Means co-chair of the Ways and Means Subcommittee understands that I do like the bill.
All right. And the discussion is wonderful, but our time is up. The clerk is here.
Madam Chair, all I need to do is serve notice of a possible minority report on Senate Bill 637.
Okay.
That's all.
Thank you. And do we have have you submitted the amendments?
The amendments are not required because this was the first public hearing for the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
So you're going to have a minority report?
Possibly.
No. Okay. So Representative Dembrough.
We
are in work session. No, we are not in work session. Closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 537A, opening a work session on Senate Bill 537A.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 537A to Ways and Means without recommendation.
Representative Dembrough moves Senate Bill 537A to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
I'm sorry, I can't.
Is there any objection? No. Seeing none, the motion passes. The bill goes to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 537A. Colleagues, it's not posted yet, but we will meet again next week, probably on Monday, to discuss our interim plans. And colleagues, the date for our committee party is going to be Monday, the 15th of June. At the Thai Orchid Restaurant. And finally, you will be getting in your offices. If you remember, previously we had a discussion about a letter to Portland State University about their teachers for the visually impaired program. We have that letter written, and we'll get that around to your offices.
Okay.
All right, the House Committee on Education is adjourned.